So
say that again. Say that again, Owen.
I have a bead on some oxibles Lock for Eric.
Radio.
There we go.
Nice. Yeah.
Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com. Tonight we have Bill Stegall. He's going to be joining us momentarily. But in the meantime, what's going on with you, Owen?
Nothing.
Oh, okay.
No.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all. No, actually, I actually finally sat down and finalized my whole freaking breeding plan for this year.
Yeah, I saw that.
So this coming year. Yeah, and it's freaking daunting when you sit down and go, all right, well, that pair, and then that pair. How many pairs is this now? Holy shit, that's 15 pairs. Holy, I really hope I don't get them all. it's when you cross your fingers that maybe you won't breed every single python that you have on your list, because then you're going to have, 200 babies.
Wow.
And, then you're like, oh, shit. And, it's unfortunate. It's great and it's bad at the same time. I could easily get over 200 babies and I'm not going to know what to do with myself. So I'll totally disappear from everything.
So what would you gear success for you as, percentage-wise? What would be a successful year? Besides 100%, obviously.
100%. I've tried. The problem is, I try, large numbers, 10. I've tried, 10 clutches. Tried to get 10 clutches before and only ended up with, 3 or 4.
Right.
Yeah. It's my thing. I have a select few clutches that I, really want something to happen. I really want those pairs. And if I can get those pairs, it's a successful thing. And then, of course, there are some other pairs that just if she goes, she goes, and we'll get some babies, and that'd be cool. But you got your heart and soul in some other pairs. I got the chance for Super Caramel Jags this year. And that's one right up at the top for me. It's need the Super Caramel Jags. And then it's the Red Tigers are right after that. And then I'm going to try like hell to get Granite Jacks because, God damn it, I'm going to breed Arian Jays before I die. So I swear to freaking Christ, I'm going to figure out white lip before I start breeding IJs, and I'm going to kill myself. So, yeah, there's a bunch of – what was that?
I was going to say that's going to be, I guess that could be good and bad. I'm not really sure how that would be.
I'm not sure either. So, but they got the several pairs, but then there are some other ones that, if they don't go this year or they don't have really interest in the male, I'm not really going to push it. So if I get over 100 babies, I call it a good year.
100 babies. Wow. That's a...
what I've been pulling. I've been covering around 180 babies a year the past 3 years.
And how many babies carry over to a season for you?
Right now, I have, from leftover from 2012, right now I have 4 babies.
Okay.
So, right. And then I have the 2013 babies, which are just starting to gear up and get sold, or, you know, get fatter and prettier. But, you know,
right.
it takes some time. I usually have some stragglers, 3 or 4, that hang around for the next year. And I'm noticing in the pattern that it's a lot of jags. Recently, past two years, the babies that have been hanging out have been jags, and they'll usually stay until they're a little over a year old, and then they'll eventually sell. So that has kind of pushed me off from breeding my jaguars. Really, this next coming season, I really kind of went light on the jags because clearly they are, not moving too quickly, and I don't want to have a bunch of jaguars hanging out for too long.
Gotcha. Yeah, it was funny. Today I spent a majority of my day building racks. Zach came over. He has, we were going back and forth for the longest time on what kind of racks to build and cages and da 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 da. And
right.
I can't remember who was the first person that I saw do this, but Hisham posted up his video of his new room, and he had those, the threaded poles. You know what I'm talking about? And they don't have sides. Okay, so basically it's a huge threaded rod, like a big screw type of it. Okay.
Yes.
So. The rack becomes adjustable. You get the melamine.
Holy shit!
Yeah, it's
really?
Pretty neat. It was pretty simple to build, and it looked really really nice. I experimented with building with Zach, so we fine tuned it, and you know.
Wait.
Really,
you're building Zach's rack, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that if they went horribly wrong, or if were a total wrong way to do things. You would know so not to do it for your stuff.
Well, we did some of the sizes of the bits and all that kind of stuff. We kind of, you know, and more clamps and all this kind of stuff that, you know, as you're going along, you learn and, you know, so you have it for the next time you go to build it. But I mean, generally speaking, I think he got, I'm going to butcher this. I think it was, I want to say maybe 20 slots. $200.
Wow. That's not bad at all.
Yeah. So didn't have to cut a piece of melamine. It was already pre-cut, ready to go. And, you know, he's ready to go.
28 slots, Zach says. You
28
failed.
Slots. Oh, 28 yeah,
slots.
It,
yeah, done.
Well, I didn't want to go too high, but, you know, it was pretty cool. And especially if you're dealing with, like, a heated room, you know, because obviously the sides aren't covered and such.
Right.
But if you're dealing with a heated room, it's pretty much a no-brainer. So I'll probably be just moving over to those type of things and building them myself. I mean, that's at this point.
I'm gonna miss the Tower of Bins.
Yeah, I know. So, but yeah, that's kind of what I did. Actually, we were talking about that though because he hatched out some jags, and he was saying that. You know, nobody was really cares about the jags at this point.
Right, and the unfortunate part is that you're dealing with a normal jag is now something that's kind of pushed to the side because if I'm going to spend the money on a jag, there's caramel jags, there's zebra jags, there's granite jags, there's 88% jungle jags, there's, you know, 98% IJ jags. I saw on something today. There's jag has been kind of spread out completely, and you have a fantastically giant, bright yellow jag that's residing in one of my cages.
Yeah.
That you and I have tried like shit to sell, and it won't go anywhere. So,
yeah.
And that just tells me, if I can drop the price of an adult male Jag that looks phenomenal down to what I'm trying to sell baby Jags for and it's still not going, it shows me that the gene, people are wanting more in it, which I am terrified of, because then we're going to get to those, become those ball python people that it's like, I only want a Jag if it's got five or six genes in it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want that.
Well, I guess from a breeding standpoint, if you're going to do a breeding project, I think it kind of makes sense that if you're trying to hit a variety of stuff, that you would want a male that would have,
yes,
like caramel or super,
yes,
caramel or even zebra, or dare I say, ocelot zebra jag.
Ocelot zebra jag. Who can we,
yeah,
talk to about ocelot zebra jags?
Yeah,
my,
well,
goodness.
Lucky
us.
Yeah.
And I totally get that idea. And it's just, it's the problem of it now is that I'm still going to be creating jags. I mean, they're going to happen because they're always going to pop up. Every time I breed my caramel jag to something, there's going to be normal jags coming out. So, you know, I think that's the way we're going to start going, is I'm going to stop gearing projects completely towards Jaguar, but I'm still going to get some just because they're just going to pop up.
Right.
So,
well,
yeah,
it may be also that maybe people are taking more of an interest in maybe the non-morphs of the carpet pythons. You know,
maybe, unlikely, but maybe. I mean,
you know, it's possible.
Yeah, you're completely right, because you're saying all my normals sell before the Jags is what you're looking at right now. I have one normal male and four Jaguars left over. So
right,
it kind of just shows you that all the Pennell stuff flew off the shelves, but the Jags kind of are hanging around still. So, yeah, people enjoy a good normal coastal, even a lot of times just as a pet. So,
yeah, let me ask you this question real quick. What is the price difference between a normal Jag and a coastal? And a
normal Jag, it is going down. That used to be a huge margin. When I was first selling Jags, you're looking at about $300, $350 for a Jag, and a normal Sib, dare I say Sib, physical pain, sorry, a normal coastal, well, I would, you know, you sell them out, if it's not a very particularly pretty one, it's $60. So I'm getting yelled,
okay,
at on the board now. But, you know, but you know, say a Pennell coastal or, you know, a Pennell stripe coastal, and, you know, I usually tend to have those priced around about $100.
Right.
Now, that's like the top. A really good-looking normal baby, $100 max is what I usually sell them for. Jags are now coming down so low that hatchling Jags are probably going to end up going for about $150, $160. So there's really not that much of a price gap between the two anymore. That's just the way the market's been going. They've just been kind of going down. And for people who are going to go, like, freak out and run around and say all is lost, Jag as a morph has held price for a very, very long time compared to other morphs that are out there and other species of snake. I mean, spider ball python came out the same year Jag did, and it was at $200 three, 4 years ago. And crashing. Like, now they throw spider ball pythons at you if you're walking by the table, hoping that you'll take it. So it's held on a lot. And
right. The
big problem, I've spoken with this with a few other breeders, is that the problem is everybody has a Jag now, and everybody has an adult Jag now. So what's the point of buying a baby Jag? They're just going to make their own. So, you know, I talked this out with Jason Balin a few years ago about the price of Jags, and he and I agreed. I'm like, I'm at three, and I'm going to stay at three as long as I can. And he said the same thing, and I think it's time that we should get a dial it back.
Yeah, so. I was just going to say, I mean, I think that the market has spoken, and it's probably the going price of three anymore.
Well, the thing is, like, I'm still going to get three for those baby Jags downstairs, but the problem is now they need to grow into their price tag. Eventually, they will be worth $300. But it depends on how long I want to keep them to grow them up to be $300 animals. And apparently that is adulthood. So I don't want to hold on to them until they're adults. So I'm going to drop the prices down. So it's just a logical step. So.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, so I guess the biggest news, and we have to hit on it before we bring Bill on, is a huge congratulations goes out to Frederick Averback. I hope I'm saying that right. I don't
You're
know
butchering
guy's
it,
name.
But
he hatched out Bull and I. He hatched them out, I think it was, I want to say September, August 31st maybe. But he deserves it.
I mean, and obviously you've seen the pictures of them on Facebook. They're gorgeous little things.
Aren't they freaking cool, man?
Bright red.
Oh, man. Yeah. I think he hatched out, I think it was four of them. I think it was 78 days. 78 days incubation.
Jesus.
Quite a long. So it was four.
This is technically the second clutch this year that have been produced in captivity. So it's almost like now we're starting to get the little building blocks. And what's great is these four Bolins were hatched out in Europe. And the Bolins that were hatched out here were, of course, done by Mark. Mark had the baby Bolins, right?
Yes, Mark Spitar.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mark had the baby Bolins, completely unrelated. So for the love of Christ, can someone just get one from Denmark and get Mark's baby and get this to work?
Here's a question. My thought is this. Well, I mean, what you have four Bolins hatch out. Would you sell any?
Every single one I keep.
Hell yeah.
Would you? Exactly. Because now I have the best. I have four little bullets that are my best shot at figuring out how to captively breed these guys. Like, say he somehow got really lucky and he got two girls, two boys. And you raise them up and they breed and you get eggs your first shot and it's the clutch is huge and they're all viable. You've done it. It's over. Completed. Now you have your pairs and you can just start churning out these captive bred Bolins and the mystery solved. You finally, it's done. So this is my best shot at producing. I'm getting it done. Just like out of my white lips and stuff like that, the biggest babies that come out of those eggs, when or if I ever get them, they're not leaving. Hell no. So it's you gotta build it up. So, oh, yeah, I wouldn't sell a single one unless, you know, of course I'm saying that, but if Paul Harris were to, like, break down my door and present me with a briefcase full of money, I would be really hard to say no.
I was just going to say, everything has a price tag. You know.
Thank you. Everything does have a price tag.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, like, how much money would you – I mean, even if, let's say, for sake of argument that you were going to sell them, what would you even put on that? I mean, because let's look at it. It's, what, 10 grand? It's, like, between 5 and 10 grand for a pair, depending on age. And you're looking at –
And that's like, what, farm-raised or some of that?
Captive hatched, yeah.
Captive
farm hatched, yeah.
Farm hatched. So this is a captive bred. So you're looking at, like, basically I would be like, so make me an offer and then see how high somebody pegged and then just stop and waited until they paid my mortgage. And then that would be the price for one. Yeah.
Awesome. So, yeah, huge congratulations go out to him. We're trying to work it out so he could come on the show and talk to us and tell us about his thoughts and the whole process that he went through to breed him. I know that the clutch was bigger. I know he had some issues with eggs. I know the female had some issues with egg retention. I know Mark had some issues too, so it seems to be, you know, something there. But all in all, four baby captive born and bred Bolins pythons, that's a huge congratulations. So I don't think that anything else I could say on the show and the cool things that I've seen throughout the week could top that. So huge congrats go out to him. And
you definitely want a baby Bolin, don't you?
Oh, hell yeah, man. Come on. Bolin's pythons, they're like the pinnacle of Morelia for me. I mean,
for you.
You know.
For you.
Yeah, for me. I mean, that's like
yeah.
the creme de la creme, say, so to speak.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right.
One day. So.
I got you.
What's that?
I got you. So, enough of this nonsense. We should just grab Bill on.
Yes. Yeah, let's get it going.
Yeah.
Wait, I got two callers here now, and I don't know which.
Holy crap!
Hey, Bill, is that you?
Hey, guys. Yes, I'm here.
Okay,
good.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Been looking forward to it for a while.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
You guys know that you brought me on to talk about Jaguars, right?
Shit. No.
I'm giving them away. I mean, you come
right.
by my place and, you know, you guys can have them.
Oh, God.
All right. Well, if it's the Steve Ocelot Jag, I'm in.
Yeah, I was going to say, it depends on which kind of a Jag.
Oh, and before we get started, I have a question to ask you. It's more of a favor.
Sure.
Listen, I've got an 18-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old son. My son's driving a Ford Mustang, and I need, like, some friendly prices on car insurance. You know, friend price, a deal. I need a deal cut.
Unfortunately, if you don't live in the state of Pennsylvania, I can't help you because I'm only licensed for Pennsylvania. So
you're killing me. They're good kids. Couple accidents, couple tickets. You know,
yeah,
they're good kids.
I can't talk. I drove my parents crazy. Several accidents and tickets and crap, so they spun me off as soon as possible. So it's funny that now I'm in charge of that kind of crap, but.
I'll keep looking.
But okay, I'll always go nationwide if you can. So I have to plug the company. So excellent. Well, now that we got that out of the way,
yeah.
Bill, why don't you tell us how you got bit by the reptile bug and kind of got all into this stuff?
Sure. Well, unlike a lot of your guests, I didn't really begin actively keeping snakes until my adulthood. I loved snakes as a kid. You know, I loved snakes. I loved dinosaurs. I was the kind of kid that just, you know, wanted to learn all the scientific names of snakes and dinosaurs. I read a lot of books about snakes and dinosaurs. At the ICAS, I talked with some of the old school guys like Eugene Bissett, John Martin. You remember some of the stories Eugene told about, you know, when he was a kid, how he...
There were so many. He wouldn't stop.
He's a talker, and I know you've had him on your show, and God, he's a character.
Uh-huh.
But these guys would tell stories about when they were kids, they'd go down to these import warehouses, and there would just be these boxes of things from South America or Asia or, you know, these crates. And they just have nothing but red skull and crossbones on them. And they go down there and they just start breaking these crates open. And they didn't know if a flamingo was going to come out or a spider or a venomous snake. You know, I mean, just crazy stuff. These are guys that are a generation ahead of me. You know, I'm in my late 40s. These guys are older than that. But there were no rules then. You know, they just, when they were kids, they'd go down there, they'd get this stuff. I don't know what they'd pay for it, or just take it, and they'd keep this stuff in their basements. You know, and they're 5 and 6 years old, keeping these venomous and giant constrictors and stuff like that. And you know, that's just not the way things worked at my house.
No,
you know?
No. That shouldn't work in a house. 6 year olds shouldn't have venomous. But
I mean,
yeah.
If I tried to bring a snake into my house when I was a boy, a young kid, my parents would have set me on fire. I mean, that's it. You know, you're done. You're out of here. So I was not able to really actively keep snakes in my house as a boy or you know, as a kid. And so with living snakes not really a viable option for me, I began collecting the closest thing. And for me, this was toy rubber snakes. You know, anywhere I went, I would buy these snakes for my birthday, Christmas. You know, I collected these rubber snakes, the bigger the better. And you guys may balk at this, but at one time I had the largest imported collection of rubber snakes in North America. They all came from China, but you know, listen, it was a massive collection. And you know, I didn't have the typical problem in my collection of bacteria or viruses, but in fact, my younger brother also had a fascination with rubber snakes, but he wasn't into collecting them. His passion was more for biting the heads off of these rubber snakes whenever the opportunity presented, and then it was completely worthless to me. All my hard work gone to waste.
Oh, that sucks.
So anyway, you know, as a young kid, I did not keep live snakes. My passion for them went dormant. I went to school for 12 years, started a family, and really my interest and passion was reborn about 15 years ago when my son asked if he could have a snake when he was 7 or 8 for a pet. And, of course, I said, that's awesome. Let's do it. And we got a normal ball python, and, you know, that was a long time ago. He's 21 years old now, and so we've gone through quite a journey since that time. You know, we began to breed ball pythons, and we got our first carpet python in 2005, and that was
awesome.
A baby coastal jag, and our collection has grown from there.
Awesome. So what brought you to bring about the Morelia? Was it just something that you and your son just kind of leaned in on and thought it was cool?
Yeah, it was a desire for something different. I think a lot of, you know, I think that opportunity is so available to us as Morelia keepers. I mean, I don't have to tell you how many ball python keepers there are. There is a hundredth of Morelia keepers, carpet keepers, chondro keepers, scrub, you know, all of the Morelia, it's just a fraction. It's a tiny fraction. And, and if we can infuse the passion for carpet pythons into people that, you know, it's a progression. You know, most people, their first snake is a ball python. And if we can infuse the passion and the knowledge and to get those people to get interested in the different species, just like I did, just like my son did, then we can resurrect or we can continue to grow this, you know, the Morelia phenomenon. I really believe that.
Awesome. That's excellent. So your company is called Phoenix Reptiles. What brought about just, you know, making it into a breeding business as opposed to just keeping maybe one or two?
Well, Phoenix is, it's a little bit confusing because I'm not in Arizona. I'm in Dallas-Fort. I'm in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, so that confuses some people. I'm in Texas. The Phoenix thing was actually done. My late father's small business was called Phoenix Enterprise, and he names his business based on the mythical Greek bird that's cyclical. It's reborn from fire. You know, a new phoenix bird then arises from the ashes. So that was kind of my experience with snakes. I had a passion for them as a kid. I was not able to keep them for the reasons talked about before. My son was interested in them, and of course, as soon as he showed a passion for them, I was on board all over it to the nth degree. And so my experience with reptiles and snakes was reborn at that point. So I think it's an appropriate name for what we decided to put together. Phoenix Reptiles, you know, we're very small, a very small outfit. It's myself, my son, Ryan Stiegel, a young man named Logan Murray, who's been working with us for 4 or 5 years, and then a young kid named Evan Broder. He's helped us out on a few projects this year. He's trying to get his carpet collection up and going, you know, his collection and his business. We're trying to help him out, and he's helped us out with some stuff. So we currently keep and breed ball pythons, carpet pythons, and as you guys know, this year we acquired our first set of chondros, which I'm very excited about, and maybe later in the show we can talk about chondros a little bit too.
That's Eric. Awesome. So that's probably Eric's portion. I'm pretending I didn't hear that first bit, though, with the other things you breed. Anyway, it sounds like great, and, you know, good for you for kind of nurturing somebody else who's looking to get his carpet business up and running. So, excellent.
No, that's what it's all about. I had help, you know, coming in, and, you know, that's the one thing that I've kind of, as I've drifted into the Condro community a little bit more, they are a very helpful set of individuals. And I would like to make the carpet python community mirror that a little bit. Condro guys, they don't put up with any shenanigans. They don't put up with any lack of knowledge or, I mean, you know, you need to be a pretty straight shooter if you're humble and you, like I was, and said, listen, I'm an experienced snake keeper, but I'm a beginning chondro keeper. These guys will open up their heart and soul to you. They'll tell you everything they know and help you as much as they can. And I'd like to see more of that, and I've tried to participate more of that in the carpet community because there are so many young, new people keeping and trying to breed carpets, and I think their success will do nothing but, you know, increase our success, the people that have been doing it a little bit longer.
Give this guy an award. Give this guy an award. I love that speech. That sounds like
do we have one?
I don't know. We better find one. But
we should make one. And moving on.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, man. That's dead on, man. You know, I couldn't agree with you more, you know. So
You guys have done a lot. I mean, you guys have done a lot to promote our fashion. You know, what you did at the ICAS, I know you guys sponsored. Who did you guys sponsor, the speaker?
We did, I can't remember her name. The one that was.
Yes.
The vet, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
God, she had a real nice presentation, a really nice talk, and, you know, you guys funded her way there, and you know, that was very admirable for you guys to do that.
I think her name was Marie Rush, apparently.
Marie Rush, yes.
Thank you. Yeah, Zach just yelled at us over the chat. Apparently we're killing him slowly. Good. Good. Good.
Good. He deserves it.
Are you listening? So...
I can't remember things like that. I just try to do what I can do. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It wasn't really important who we were bringing, just as long as we were bringing somebody and helping those guys out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good times. But so carpet pythons. I mean, you got some cool stuff. I was checking out your website, and obviously there's one that, you know, that you hatched out this season that I want to talk about, but. Let's talk about maybe an overview of what you got. I know you said you're working with Jags and Coastals.
Sure.
What else do you have?
Well, I've got about a dozen breeder carpets. My original was a male Coastal Jag. I obtained him in 2005. A friend of mine, really the lineage of him is unknown. A friend of mine purchased him in San Antonio at a reptile show for me. I essentially purchased him sight unseen. I knew nothing about Jaguars at that time, and I was really just plain lucky that he ended up being really a very, very sharp example of a pure Coastal Jag. About the same time, I obtained two adult female jungle carpets from Sean Christian, and shortly after that, I bought a massive IJ female from a girl who had been keeping it as a pet. The IJ female was 9 or 10 when I acquired her, just the biggest IJ I've ever seen. She was every bit as big as my Coastal Jag male. And these animals were the heart of my collection and have been very productive for me. I bred the Jag male to the two jungles in 2007 and produced my first clutch of jungle Jags in 2008. And then I began breeding them to the IJ female in 2008, in addition to the two jungle females. So he triple dipped for 4 years. And the three females laid clutches in 2009, 2010, and 2011. They were all rested in 2012. And that was last year, and that's when I began breeding some of their offspring. Those were the ocelot jag females. So,
very cool.
You, I've just been very fortunate. We're a very small time facility. You know, I've got a one car garage that essentially serves as my snake room, and you know, we've held back 6 or 7 female jags that are now breeders. In addition, this year I acquired some 88% diamond adult pythons, which I love. They're beautiful animals. I would have gotten pure diamonds, but I'm just afraid my climate, my temperature down here in Texas just would not support them. So I decided to get 88% diamond pythons, and I got those from Gary Schiavano. Do you know Gary? You guys know Gary?
Yeah. Yeah.
He paired them in 2012. The female did not go despite multiple locks, and so I'm going to try to put them to work this year, try to get some diamond blood into the jag stuff I produced.
Okay. That's cool.
Excellent.
That stuff, I was going to say earlier when me and Owen were talking, but it seems like to me the jungle jags and the diamond jungle jags are pretty much the staple as far as jags go. I mean, I was looking at your striped jungle jaguars. Good Lord. I mean, they're just freaking insane. Those things are so nice. Nearly a solid stripe down the back on some of them, and wow,
right,
beautiful stuff.
Right. Hopefully we can talk about the stripe stuff a little bit later, because I did, go on with a project with Moana. Involving some stripe stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can talk about that in a little bit.
They were nice.
I think, you know, certainly the jungle jaguars are the most popular, at least what I see posted Facebook and on the MoreliaPythons.com forum. They seem to be the most prevalent. I don't necessarily think they're the best. I've seen some IJ jags, some brittle jags. I mean, I've seen coastal jags that are just stunning, but it seems like the jungle jags have become the most popular of the crosses.
Right. As we get into the show, make sure when we get into breeding, I want to ask you a little more in depth about breeding the male to over 3 females. But before we get to that, let's talk about the ocelot gene. This is sort of a mystery in the carpet python world. Some people have their thoughts on what it is. Other people's, completely different thoughts, and you know, I'm just curious if you can break it down to what your thoughts are, you know.
Sure, absolutely. The ocelot trait, I've been excited about it for a long time, but because of some of the breeding results from this year, I've become super excited about it. But before we kind of dive into a discussion about it, there, as you alluded to, there is some confusion or controversy really about the term ocelot. And, you know, Paul Harris first coined the term ocelot when he produced a 75% jungle jag in 2006 that had an unusual pattern. And the pattern was described as having the traditional saddle areas that have a color that matches the undercolor of the jag exactly. So, in other words, if traditional jag patterning, you know, the saddle areas, some are black, brown, orange, blushed, whatever, but not the exact same color as the yellow in the rest of the jag. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
So the ocelot jag has these areas where the undercolor is the same as the rest of the jag. In addition to that, Paul and Mike Curtin describe, I think they refer to it as a busy pixelated pattern on the animal as well. And that's the part of the equation that my ocelot jaguars do not have. They have the ocelot patterning, the saddles that are empty or, you know, the same color as the undercolor of the jaguar, but they don't have those pixelated, busy patterns. And, in fact, I've asked Mike Curtin, and I've asked actually Sean Christian to call in to the show and maybe give their input about some of the similarities and differences. I don't know if they're going to be able to do that or not, but I have asked them to do it. Sean Christian feels that they're the same trait as Paul and Mike's. Paul and Mike's are just either a heavier or a different expression of that trait. And that's really what I think as well. Sean is actually the one, I think I mentioned that I acquired my first two jungle carpet females from Sean, and I was very excited when I produced my first clutch of jaguars. He lives about 45 minutes north of me, and so I asked him to come, and he came and he looked at the clutch, and he is the one that said, wow, these, you know, some of these jaguars in here have an ocelot patterning. And that was the first time I'd ever heard the term. So basically, I'm going to blame all of this confusion on Sean.
Well, we do have, I do have Mike Curtin on the phone right now. So.
Fantastic. Hey,
yeah.
Hey Mike.
Yeah. Hey, Mike. How are you
doing? Good.
Pretty good.
I'm doing well. I'll join everybody in blaming Sean.
Hi, cool.
We've accused this. This is that was is such a cool animal, those ocelot zebras that you produced, Bill.
Thank you, Mike.
Just phenomenal. The difference between the ocelli or those open saddles and that pixelation, you know, when you produce those crazy pixelated ocelot zebras from your other, and we chatted on Facebook about it a little bit, you know, and I told you, you know, I wouldn't have called your adult ocelots, but
right.
The babies they produce they're phenomenal, you know, they're definite, like, it's crazy, so.
You see some of the similarities in the babies to some of the stuff that you've produced and what you've seen, though?
Oh, absolutely, you know, it just... You know, exact. And it's so cool because it's just enhanced by the zebra gene, you know, really, really wild looking. So all that pixelation, I mean, obviously with the zebra jag, you've got that busy zebra gene working with the jag, but you could tell there's something else going on. You can tell there's that third kind of anomaly in there, you know.
Well, I was very hesitant to breed a zebra to my ocelot jag females because I was fairly certain, convinced that the zebra pattern would wash the ocelot trait out. I thought it would overwhelm it. So
yeah,
I almost didn't do it.
Hello?
Kind of had the same concern, you know, last year when I gave one of my zebras a shot, and he's just too small. But
that was going to be my question. If you produced anything like this, Mike, or something like your lines with your ocelots, I know you have a bunch of them.
I bred, what was that pairing? Jigsaw to his sister.
Okay.
Jigsaw was my original ocelot with
right.
all that pixelation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I bred him to his sister. Now, his sister has the open saddles, but I never really considered her an ocelot. And when all those babies were produced, all the jags, you can definitely see they've got it. They've got something going on. They've got, you know, anywhere from just very little pixelation to a lot of pixelation. I got my most aberrant ocelot from that pairing. But at the same time, I'm finding that same type of pixelation in the normal siblings from that clutch, you know, which I've thrown a couple of those pictures up there. And I pretty much, I held back most of them.
Mm-hmm.
All the jags I kept, two of the normals, went to Jerry Emerson from that clutch. And obviously I'll have access to them, but I'm going to try to see if we can do something to isolate that ocelot gene, see what's going on.
I haven't noticed any of the ocelot-type patterning in any of my non-jags. So the siblings in those clutches, to me, I've seen none of that patterning. They've all looked just like normal sibs.
Okay. Have you seen any of the pictures of the normals that I've posted up?
No, Mike, I have not.
I'm gonna shoot some over to you. Over the next day or so. I gotta get some new pictures and show you, kind of just show you what I'm looking at, what I'm seeing. And it, what's cool is it doesn't look, you know, you can tell it's there, you know, but if it was just a regular average jungle, you know, I'd say, hey, wow, that's a pretty neat pattern, and move on.
Right.
You know.
You got to kind of be looking for it, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Mike, so, that's not the jungles you have on your Facebook page that kind of have that yellow inside the black, like the circles of yellow inside the black? More so, I don't know what it was. I saw a picture of it's just a kind of like a headshot of a jungle, but it looks like a little different than jungles that I've seen.
It's probably from the same. It's from the same line. All right.
Okay.
It's the female that produced Jigsaw is Delia, you know, a lot of them, you know, a lot of my jungle stuff that I have available came from her.
Okay.
So I've got, you know, some new stock that I've gotten in, you know, but a lot of the jungles that I've held back that I've kept, you know, have started with her.
How many clutches has she laid, Mike?
What's that?
How many clutches has she laid?
Oh, she's laid... I bred her, the first time I bred her was 2007, so 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and she was off last year, so 5 clutches.
Wow.
Jeez.
Yeah, she's a superstar. She's really, really...
That's fantastic.
A little slut.
To be ready. Yeah, man, she's a little bit of a hussy. But I tell you what, man, I'm hoping for she should give a good number of eggs this year too. So
fantastic,
cool, very cool.
Mike, has been. I mean, it's great to hear your input. I think there are some similarities in the two traits. I think it may take more time to piece together exactly, you know, what the similarities, what the differences are. But I really do think they are similar. They're inherited in a very similar pattern, it seems like. It certainly isn't at least in my stuff, it's not the traditional dominant or recessive pattern. It kind of puts it in that polyallelic or polygenic mode of inheritance, which is kind of a hodgepodge. At least in my animals, these traits can have variable penetrance, meaning that, you know, some of these jags are lightly ocelot patterning. Some are moderate, and some are just freaky, heavily patterned. I have noticed, though, and especially this year, that the higher percentage jungle in these jaguars increase the chance that you're going to see ocelot patterning. I've seen, you know, quite a few animals posted as, and again, I'll use my term ocelot, not Mike Curtin's term, but what I'm used to seeing ocelot. I've seen quite a few animals, and they're all 75%, 88% jungle jags. And so my observation has been that the higher percentage jungle jags, the more likely you are to see these ocelot babies in the offspring.
That's not necessarily true in my experience, because of, and this is going off of one clutch that kind of surprised me. When I dropped it back down, I actually, when I bred Jigsaw to his paternal aunt, who is only a 50%er, all right,
mm-hmm.
wound up with, what is it, 62% jungle,
right.
Somewhere around there. That's when I actually got two of my most heavily patterned, Link and Pepper, came from that pairing.
Okay.
And they're very, you know, distinctly ocelots, you know. So it's kind of crazy the way it's the way it's being inherited. And I don't know, you know, and definitely it seems like it almost has to be over 50% jungle, you know. But as far as, it's almost like, you know, the line breeding is definitely helping with that a little bit too.
Yeah, you know, all of my animals, my breeding ocelot females, they're 50%. You know, it was a pure coastal male to a normal-looking jungle carpet female, and about 30% of the offspring have this ocelot patterning.
Okay.
So, you know, again, that's a 50%. Now, the animals that I produced this year, when I bred 50% jungle jag female, she's ocelot, heavily ocelot pattern. I bred it to a pure zebra male. The zebra male is not my zebra male. It's actually owned by Jim Hill out of California. We did a breeding loan. It's it was produced by Jason Balin. Phenomenal looking zebra. But
okay, hey, let me stop you real quick. That zebra male was produced by breeding Jason Zebra to Delia.
Oh.
Ah, is that right?
Yeah, Delia produced that zebra.
Sweet.
And you know Jim Hill. You know that animal.
I don't know Jim Hill, but that was produced through a breeding loan with Jason Balin.
Okay.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Because Jim got that from Jason, right?
Yes.
To be breed
to Paul Harris line, Paul Harris line zebra.
Okay, yeah. In order for me to have been breedable this year, he would have been produced by Delia.
Yeah,
cool.
The zebra male's a 3-year-old. He was 3 when I bred him in 2012. So does that make sense?
No. Wait. He was 3 when you bred him in 2000 this past season?
Yes.
Okay, you know what? Then it's not. All right. I thought he was just of size. Okay, scratch that. It wasn't produced by... If it was... It was produced by Paul then?
It was... According to Jim Hill, it was produced by Jason, but it was a Paul Harris line zebra.
Well, it's because... Isn't that where Jason got his original male zebra was Paul?
Correct.
But it depends on what the girl was. So it could have been, if it's just getting of age, though, didn't he do that breeding with Headhunter? The Headhunter female.
Yeah, my breeding was before that.
Yeah.
2010 was when, I think it was 2010, yeah. 2010 was when I loaned Jason Delia.
Right, because I have a Brinkley, and that's 2011. So.
He may have been produced the year before that, but I can confirm that with Jim Hill.
Okay.
But either way,
that would be interesting.
That would be very interesting, and I will definitely track that down. But the point that I was making is the clutch that was produced from those two animals. You know, there weren't a whole lot of just regular jaguars produced. I mean, you had zebras, you had jaguars, you had zebra jags, and you have siblings. And so the number of jaguars, and we actually produced two clutches. That zebra male was bred to two of my ocelot females, and there were ocelot zebra jags and ocelot jags from both of those clutches. But the regular jaguars, almost every one of them was ocelot. I think there was one that was not. So, you know, again, they're now 75%. Zebra jags, and so the percentage of ocelot was even higher than what I produced in my 50% zebra clutches the generation before.
Nice.
Okay.
That's interesting stuff. That would be really cool if you could trace back to that clutch. Because I'm not sure if Jason did a zebra pairing before the one with you, Mike. I think
the That was actually his first one because
that's
yeah.
what I
you know,
thought. Yeah.
Okay. I remember him laughing about it because his zebra was only like 400 something grams.
Yeah.
You know. yeah, I remember that.
If that was his first one, then it has to be from that clutch.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's definitely interesting. I'm putting my male zebra from that clutch. I'm putting him up to Camille this year. And
nice.
she's the girl that produced all those ocelots 2 years ago.
I've got a good feeling about that pairing.
Yeah, me too.
Nice.
See what happens. Fingers crossed.
You know, and again, just going back on my own very small, limited personal experience, I think that jungle or the non jaguar animal that you pair with that jag is very important. Because, you know, my coastal jag male, he's bred several different females, jungle, IJ, and none of the babies are ever ocelotted pattern. It's only with this one particular jungle that their babies, you know, throw the ocelot patterning. And she looks completely normal. She doesn't have any kind of ocelot trait associated with her at all. So I think the non-jaguar animal that you pair it with is really what determines if the babies are going to be ocelot patterned or not.
I absolutely agree.
It would be interesting for me to breed a different jaguar to this particular female jungle and see if, again, she throws ocelot, and maybe I'll do that in the future.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, that's not a bad idea either. You know, so.
Cool stuff.
But
cool.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, that is for sure. So, what you doing? Any other ocelot pairings this year, Mike?
I'm just doing doing that one, and I don't know if you've ever seen my ocelot Chloe that. I gave to Chad Quill, a good friend of mine up in Massachusetts. I'm sending Link up with Chloe this year.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
Chloe's ready, Link's ready, so it's going to be a visual ocelot to visual ocelot.
Wow.
Holy hell.
So, Mike, is that's going to be a jag to jag pairing?
Yeah, it's going to be jag to jag pairing.
Fantastic.
The jag-to-jag pairings are the ones that have gotten me the best results with the ocelots.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was just like 3 years in a row, you know, getting the most aberrant visual ocelots.
Very interesting.
It's funny you say that. There was a caller earlier, and I didn't get to click him on, but he was saying that he heard that there's some kind of thought that if you breed the jag to jag, the ocelot makes Lucy's that are viable.
Oh, Lord.
you know what? I hope he's not speaking off of what I've said. You know, I think I was joking with somebody. It's like, hey, who knows? Maybe you'll do it and you'll get a live Lucy.
Oh. Okay.
So I hope he didn't take that as, hey, this is what's going to happen. But this is going back a few years ago, and, you know, I've done it like 3 times since, and, you know, no deal.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Thank God. again, we have to do this again.
Hey, great results, just no live Lucy's.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, the other ones are, like, burning your eyes yellow, but the white ones are all dead. So,
yeah.
We're good. We're good. Fine.
Yeah, no doubt.
Good stuff. All right.
Awesome.
I think the next thing I'm going to do with my ocelot females is I'm going to get some diamonds. I'm going to breed them, you know, to diamonds this year. I'm going to repeat my pairing with the same zebra male, but I'm also going to – I've got 4 ocelot females, so I'm going to repeat the pairing and with 2 of them, and then at least one of the others, I'm gonna breed to an 88% diamond and see what the diamond pattern does to Ocelot. Will it wash it out? Will it enhance it? Will it, you know, I don't know.
I have a caramel zebra male going to an Ocelot Jag female that I got from Paul Harris this season.
That's
so.
Just sick.
No kidding. I haven't seen a picture of that.
What, my Ocelot Jag?
No.
Oh yeah. I don't know. Tucked away somewhere.
You're hiding pictures of your Ocelot Jag. I've been asking you for pictures of that female since you got her.
I'll have to get her over.
Show Eric the love. Let's go, man.
Yeah.
Come on now.
All right, I'll have to put her up. I'll put her on the photo block. I'll get Zach over here and take some pictures.
All right.
Should be cool.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. I'll
be cool.
Well, gents, with that, I'm gonna sign off.
Okay.
All right.
Hey, Mike.
Well,
Mike,
thanks
a lot,
Mike.
Man. Appreciate your input.
I'll see you Sunday, Mike. So,
yeah.
You're gonna be at White Plains. All right. Excellent.
Yeah, I'll be at White Plains.
I'll let you tempt me with things. It's cool. So.
Okay. Cool. Hey, Bill, Sean, you taking the trip up?
I'm not gonna be able to make it. There's no way.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
A short plane ride. Come on.
I've already blown my wad at the ICS, so I got rain back.
Gotcha.
Very, very cool. All right, guys. Well, enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm gonna get home. I'll talk to you.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Yeah. All right, bye bye.
Okay, cool stuff. So
he's going to tempt me with an ivory jungle this weekend. I know he is, and then I'm going to be, like, doomed.
you know, my just on a side note, my beautiful,
yeah.
beautiful ivory male that I have came from
yes.
Mr. Curtin. Came from Mr. Curtin. Oh, man, that thing phenomenal.
Shut up, all right? Because you know I got that ivory jag that, yeah, it's enough of you.
Yeah. Eric, how old's that ivory that you have?
2009.
2009, wow. And so what's he produced?
Nothing.
Has he produced? No, I haven't bred him yet.
Are you just waiting for him to get a little bigger? You know, what, he's,
yeah, well,
he's like 12 years
I'm
old
very...
or something.
I'm very particular with my pairings. I don't.
Sorry.
You shut up, Owen. I'm very particular with my pairings, and the female that he's going with is not up to size. Actually, believe it or not, he was he was geared to go with my Ocelot Jag female.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
But we totally revamped that project.
Bumped him out of the picture, didn't you?
Yeah, I have a female ivory, but she's not as nowhere near as nice as he is. I also wanted to breed him into my Striped Jungle project to make striped ivory jungles.
Right.
So, you know, none of those females are of age yet. Probably won't be until 2015, but, you know,
yeah.
I'm a patient man.
I would love to see some ivory ocelot or even ivory zebra. Because now you're tempting me because I got that ivory jag downstairs and I'm like, oh, that'd be great. No. Some of the horrible niches. So, yeah.
Wow.
I'll consider it.
Owen, did you really produce 140 or 180? Were they all Aurelia babies?
180, yeah.
All of them were Aurelia.
Whenever Sophie shakes loose and drops like a clutch of 52, I go close to 200. She only produced one for me this year, which is why I think we hovered close to around like 100 babies. So, yeah.
Well, you know, you talked about the number of holdovers you had, 4 or something for the year. And,
yeah.
You know, that's always my concern when I produce animals is because I can't keep them all. I mean, I will
right.
keep them all if I have to.
Right.
I don't want to.
Pulling Eric and Yeah, people got to fight you with a stick to get you to sell something. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, but you have, you know, I want to sell them. I want to share them and to sell them. And I'm always concerned every year about, am I going to be able to, you know, to sell everything I produce? And you know, I've been able to. And
it's not really that big of a concern, especially with the market being so ranged and so wide. You're not just the guy at your local snake shows selling to the same people you see every time. You've got the whole of the internet, and you know, you've got the whole country. And I've packed up and sent a baby to South Carolina and three to California in the past 2 weeks. You know, that's the way it goes. So
it's I always get concerned, you know, like I said, that I'm going to produce stuff and not be able to sell it. I have the capability to care for them all, and that's not the issue. But in order for me to continue to press my breeding projects, I have to sell some of them. I mean, I have to make space.
Right.
You know, so I'm just very encouraged that, although it scares me a little bit, every year I'm able to sell everything I produce. And I think it's a testament to people, you know, like you and to Eric, produce good stuff, take care of your stuff, be passionate about it, and the stuff will sell. I mean, it always has.
Yeah, there's really no problem with that. It's not like I'm holding on to 50 or so babies by the time eggs are hatching next year. I mean, we'll still have a good amount of babies, but I like having that so I can keep a show presence as well as have some stock kind of hanging around. Also, it helps me pick out my my whole backs a little easier.
It does. It's everything for your whole back projects, because if you're not able to produce a fairly large number of babies, you're not able to hold back those really special ones. You know, if you couldn't sell your animals, and at least if I couldn't, then I would rapidly decrease the number of babies I produced every year. I'd still produce some babies, but I certainly couldn't produce in the order of, you know, 150, 200 babies if I couldn't sell any of them. And the ability to produce that many is what gives people like you and me and Eric the ability to hold back some very special animals.
Yeah, I haven't released any pictures of my super caramel female holdback, but she's pretty. Anyway, so I do that just to taunt Eric, because he's like, take pictures, man, and I'm like, I don't know. So,
well, maybe Zach needs to come over to your place too and take.
He doesn't have a light pen big enough for my things. You know, he can only take pictures of little dinky things. Oh, Eric, you're still here. I'm sorry. So,
I don't know if you just offended Eric more or Zach.
Oh, man. You're full of them tonight, Owen.
I'm sorry. I got a little jazz. I'll
like
calm down now.
Six Red Bulls before you came on the show or something, or what?
he's burning some bridges.
Might as well.
Cool stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't even know where we were now, Owen.
Totally
you got
off track.
All...
I think we're on breeding and keeping.
Before we did that, I wanted to talk about the striped jungle jags. I think Eric mentioned stripes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
I've got a striped project. It's actually a very similar story to the ocelot pattern animals. I bred that same coastal jag male to a non-striped jungle carpet female, and they just they've produced four clutches, you know, together, and just a significant number of those jags are striped to some degree, including some that are 50% to 75% striped. And,
wow.
So again, it's just one of those inheritance modes, and I think striping in carpet's been pretty well described. They lump it into that polygenic mode of inheritance. Nick has described it in his book. A guy named Roger Lester, who I don't know, wrote a nice article about striping in jungle carpets. You can find that
from
article.
Australia.
Yes, he's from Australia.
Yeah.
His article's called A Guide to Striping and Pattern Inheritance in the Jungle Carpet Python. And if you just Google that, you can find it. Really neat article that kind of describes striping in jungles. This year, Moana McAdams and myself entered into a breeding project. We did the dreaded jag-to-jag pairing of, I think, Eric, you mentioned that striped jungle jag of mine that's completely heavily striped, 50-60% of her body. I sent that animal to Moana, and she bred it to that freak of hers, Anarchy. You know that animal?
Oh, my God. Lord, no.
Anarchy, he's an 88% jungle jag. He's so reduced that it's hard
just
to appreciate any
yellow.
Bright yellow, very reduced. Hard to appreciate striping in him, but if you look at him, you can tell he's striped. He's a striped animal. And so she bred the pair, did a great job with them, and we ended up with four jaguars out of that clutch. All of them heavily striped, 75% pure dorsal black stripes. So, again, a neat project. I think we're going to repeat the pairing. She lost, she probably lost 6 or 8 eggs in incubation. They were probably the leucistic animals.
Probably.
That died. I felt pretty fortunate to get four jags out of it. Mm. So, we're going to repeat that pairing. I can't wait to see how they color up, but they're heavily striped.
Cool.
Awesome.
Now, let me ask you this question. As far as the striping, do you think that the more you breed the striped animals together, that you will get the side stripe as well, as along with the back stripe?
Eric, I don't know about that, to be honest. The animals that I have produced, at least the jaguars, have all been backstriped, dorsal striped. I haven't seen any really side striping in them. So I don't know. I'm more interested in the dorsal striping.
Okay. The reason I was, because you brought up the paper by Roger Lester, and one of the things that he talked about with the, because again, what they consider in Australia a striped jungle tiger, is what we consider a tiger here, similar, the gene kind of works the same, or I should say genes work the same.
Right, genes, genes, yeah. Gotcha. His paper absolutely, it addressed jungle carpets. It did not address jaguars.
Yeah, but I'm just curious, with the tigers, it was saying how, when you start to see the pattern on the side reduce and you see certain markers that if you breed that to a striped animal, you'll refine it. And I think of, I guess you guys are familiar with Manyard carpet pythons in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Tribal jungle jags or whatever they are, where that has the complete stripe along the side,
right,
along with the one on the back. So, I don't know. I was
just
curious
if you
were kind of going in the same direction or.
I would refine that if it were present in my animals, but it's not.
Okay.
I just have not seen it.
Okay. And the back black stripe is fabulous as well. And now you're starting to see that in zebras too. I'd be curious to see if you would breed those jags that you have to a zebra.
To a zebra.
And see if you could refine a zebra jag with that back stripe as well. So
absolutely,
cool.
I think that'd be fantastic. I tell you the length that zebras have come since, the initial one, they look so much better. God,
yes, they do.
Tons
better.
The first zebra that I saw, I mean, it looked terrible to me. I it just didn't look that good. Paul Harris's initial zebra that I've seen pictures of, but every generation, God, they look better and better. And I think some of them, I mean, they're so bright yellow, they look like zebra jags. They're incredible. I love them. I love zebras. I'm not a big fan of the super zebra, but God, I love zebras.
It's that great chaotic pattern, I'm guessing.
Busy.
Something about that.
Busy.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I, it's funny you bring up that how just in the short time the Zebra has been refined, and I think of that, you know, with the jungles again, because you have these super lines of jungles that have been refined over the years, and you know, because they've been refined, you're even making the morphs that you're breeding those jungles too. Even, you know, your outcome is even better because, it just goes to show. And again, while I go back to my breeding is very selective because I don't think that you should just put one animal with another animal for the sake of making animals.
You should be paying attention.
And I think people sometimes pay attention to a gene and not what is going on in both animals, you know.
True.
And that's kind of why I focus the way I focus. But imagine what could happen with the other type of carpet pythons if, you know, if it can turn around that quick because of the refinement that's been done with the jungle, you know.
Yep. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's the zebras have become so phenomenal so fast because you're exactly right. The zebras, you know, you got to have some coin to get a zebra. You know, you got to have some money.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna breed it to a muddy jungle carpet. You know, you're gonna breed it to a very high yellow, very high contrasting, stellar animal. And so, boom, one generation later, you're coming out with some phenomenal looking zebras.
Yeah, absolutely. So good stuff. Yeah. Go ahead, Owen. It's all yours. But make sure when you guys are talking about the breeding, I want to hit on that putting a male over three females. But
definitely. So,
I'm
Bill.
Curious,
it is curious. I want to know how to do that. I've only ever gotten a male to go with two females. But so why don't you walk us through what you do with your how you keep your carpets, and how you keep how you get them ready for breeding, how you go through the process of cycling, if you do cycle, all that fun stuff.
Sure. I'm a big believer of, you know, I'm a hobbyist. I'm not like Nick Mutton. I'm not like Justin. I'm not like a lot of people out there that have gone to Australia, that have studied the animals and their natural habitat. You know, I'm a hobbyist, and I have tried to take information garnished by those people, and I've tried to fit it in to scenarios that work well for me. And I think that, you know, different parts of the country, you will have success based on different ways you do things. I'm certainly not the one kind, my way or the highway kind of keeping and breeding person. I think that many different ways can work well depending where you are geographically, you know, what you have to work with as far as, you know, are you breeding in a dedicated room? Are you breeding in your home? I think there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat, so to speak. So I'll just say that what I've done works well for me in this part of the country. You know, I live in the South. I live in Texas where it's very hot. The winters are very mild. The summers are very hot. And for anybody that's trying to establish a breeding program in carpets, I think the best thing you can do is find somebody successful in your area, in your geographic zone, and find out how they do it. It may be very different from the way that I do it or the way that Nick does it in, you know, freaking the northwest, you know, of the country where his climate is completely different than mine. So I'll just throw that out there. My particular setup, I do have a dedicated detached building that is my snake room. It's a 1.5 car garage that we dedicated, put a hotel, motel type AC heating unit that's on a programmable thermostat. It allows me to maintain very strict temperature control of the room at all times. This means that the heater may run at night when it's cool and the AC may kick on later in the day when it gets hot. And I think that helps me a lot to be able to do that. During the summer, my ambient room temperatures, I usually keep it to 82 to 84 degrees. I do provide a basking temperature of 90 to 95 degrees for babies and adults. My adults do get a 3-degree ambient temperature drop at night, and a 5-degree temperature drop in their basking area.
Okay.
For babies and subadults, I don't even do a nighttime drop in their basking area. They do get obviously the ambient nighttime drop, but I keep them a little bit warmer. I keep the heat cranked up 24/7 on the babies and the subadults.
Mm-hmm. I do the same thing. I don't really let my guys get any colder. There's no point. But, yeah, I got you.
During the summer, there's just no reason not to.
Yeah.
I feed heavy. I've told you, I feed my babies and I feed my juvie carpets. I feed them heavy. I think, the first thing that most people see when they see a yearling carpet of mine is they say, oh, wow, I need to feed my snake more. Because usually...
You and I are on the same page, so I got you.
Undoubtedly, mine will be twice the size of a year of age than most people's carpets that I see. And
excellent.
I think I heard maybe Mike said that somebody's, my original Coastal Jag male bred when he was 18 months old. I fed the crap out of him. He got big. He got big fast. He didn't get obese. I think it's impossible to get a baby or a juvenile carpet obese. I really do. I mean, I've never seen it. I feed them. They grow fast. Obviously, when they get bigger, they reach near maturity, adulthood. I back that feeding way down because carpets,
right.
Adult carpets can get obese. I have seen that. And my feeding schedule totally changes when they get to that part of their life. But I'm a big believer in heavily feeding carpets. Again, if you can provide, I think I keep my carpets warmer than a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I keep my ambient temperatures warm. I keep my hot spot warm. I give them the ability to thermoregulate. I keep my adults and most of them are in 4x2 cages.
Right.
I also have a 6-high rack from ARS. The tubs are like 40 inches by 30 inches. It's a huge rack tub system. They can get on the heat. They can get off the heat. They can get close to the heat. So I heat them and I feed them heavily. What else? Lights. I do a 12-hour on, 12-hour off during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I do decrease those lightings. Maybe I'll go 10 hours on and 14 hours off during the winter breeding season. In the winter, I think we talked about I'll drop those room temperatures 5 degrees. So
uh-huh.
Maybe my ambient temperature will be the 78 to 80 degrees during the day. Nothing magical about breeding. I introduce males in with females.
And then there you go.
Right. I mean, it sounds funny, but you got to make sure you got a male and a female.
Right.
Sometimes
it's harder than you think.
Sometimes it's harder than you think. And baby carpets are notoriously difficult to sex as babies. I've sexed hundreds, and I really only feel in the last couple years I've gotten very good at it. 5 years ago, I tell you, I think it's here it's a male. I think it's a 50% chance it's a male, 50% chance it's a female. But, obviously with like everything with some experience, you get better at it. You can accurately sex hatchling carpets. But it's tough. It's not like sexing a ball python. They're very small. It can be done. I do it right out of the egg. I think that's the best time to do it. They haven't gained that tone yet. They're not biting the crap out of you when you try to do it.
Most of them aren't. Yeah.
most of them aren't. So I like to hatch them right out of the egg, and now I'm probably 90%. I'm 100% if I tell you it's a male, because I'd never call an animal a male unless I visibly see the hemipenes. there's some females that are, you know, they're probably get missex. I think it's a small percentage, at least now, you know, in my recent history. It's not easy to do.
No, it's not.
You know, so basically you have to wait till the animal, you know, if I can get an animal in my hands that's 18 months old and I can probe it, then I can give you, a 90% assurance rate that it's male or female. But I tell everybody, you know you have a male and you know you have a female. When you put them together, you see them lock and the female lays eggs. That's when you know you have a male and a female. Anytime other than that, it's not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I've had my one jag, Aurora, her tail was really, really long. And there are these people once at a show were like, I swear to God, man, that tail's so long, it's a boy. I'm like, trust me, it's a girl. They're like, it's a boy. And I'm like, really? Here's pictures of her laying eggs. I know it's a girl. So it's so a lot of times all those myths and things kind of come right around. You're exactly right. You don't know if it's a boy or a girl until you prove it. That's why it's called proving. So
That's why I've brought proven male, proven female, proven breeder. My breeding, I introduce males into females. I think Eric was asking about, I have my male coastal, I've introduced and have been successful with three different females, and he hasn't done it 1 year, 2 year. You know, he's done it for 4 years. He's able to produce, to breed three different females. It's, he's a very big male. He's, in the chondro world, they call him a rapist. You know, he'd lock up with a large sausage.
Piece of rope if it showed interest,
Anything, my arm, anything that's long and tubular, he just wants to lock up to it. And I offer food to both my males and females during breeding season, smaller, less frequent meals. But I offer them both meals. Anytime they'll eat, I'm glad that they'll eat. The females will go off feed.
Okay.
And that's a good sign. That's a good sign when they do. A lot of times the males, most of the males don't. I mean, in my experience, they'll continue to eat small meals sporadically.
Okay.
Real quick, I was kind of listening to you guys and you were talking, and a couple of things piqued my interest. One, the fact of the tent, you don't drop below 75. I found that this year doing that, I didn't have that great success. That's interesting. Now,
it might just be because the drop is enough for, Bill in Texas. The drop might not be enough for us here.
I understand that. What do you drop yours to? What do you drop?
I drop them to close to 72. Maybe in a few nights I'll give them a little bit below 70, or closer to 70. But I usually get it down to 72.
Is there
my temps I've never had a temperature less than 75 in my room. I don't think ever.
Now, let me ask you this question, Bill. I'm just curious, just because I like to pick people's brains with this. Is there a reason why you do that, or is that just something that you've gone with and it worked?
You know, initially I did it, I think, for a couple reasons. You know, first of all, my ambient temperature's outside. I don't like to have a drastic change, in the temperature, because I think they can sense that. They can sense the temperature outside of the room.
Okay.
So I've tried to keep it on the warm side, just knowing where I am geographically.
Okay.
And then the other reason, initially when I was kind of a younger keeper, the threat of respiratory infection, I always equated it with dropping your temperatures too much might predispose your animals to respiratory infection. I've since changed my mind, my thinking on that. I don't think that is true at all. I think it's probably the stress of breeding that would be more likely to do that. I've never had a respiratory infection in the carpet, ever.
Right. That was going to be my next question. So go ahead.
I've never had it. I've battled it a couple of times in ball pythons very infrequently. I can count the number of respiratory infections in my room on my hand, and you know, I've been keeping and breeding for over a decade. So maybe it's temperature. I don't think that it is. To be honest, if I wasn't getting good results with breeding, I would lower my temperatures more and not fear increased respiratory infection. But initially when I started breeding, that was my mindset.
Right. The reason that my thought is that I've kind of talked to a few people about this, is that and you'll be able to relate to this. Ball pythons, they pretty much go all year round, right?
As far as breeding.
I mean,
no,
I've seen breeders.
No. Well, I mean, I think you can. I think you can breed them. I don't breed mine. I cycle them as well.
Okay. But breeders do breed them. They've done it where they've had clutches. It
sure,
almost seems like it's going into the next year, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess my thought is that you never see that, though, with carpets. Now, that could be because nobody tries, or it
True.
Could be because they need that temperature drop. They just won't go at any other time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was kind of where I was coming from and thinking that way.
I agree, but I do provide a temperature drop. Maybe is extreme.
Right. Well,
so
maybe
yeah.
you're doing coastals and jungles, so maybe the reason is because that's another thing that I've learned, is that keeping the different subspecies, they seem like IJs, for me, they're kind of a no-brainer. They just go.
Shut up.
You just insulted Owen, I think.
You jerk.
Yeah, because they
you're
don't
an
need
idiot
to,
if you can't breed IJs.
They don't need quite the drop. I've noticed it just in my collection.
Right.
And my thought is because they sit closer to the equator, and they're in a climate where it's pretty much, you know, a wet season and a dry season, and I don't know. It seems like the farther you go down, the more drastic a drop, and that's kind of why you were saying earlier is why you don't have diamond pythons, because you were feeling that maybe you weren't able to get to that low of a drop, right?
Absolutely. I'd keep pure diamonds in a heartbeat. I love them. and Sean Christian does. He's got a pair. He actually brought them to the NARBC show in Arlington a couple months ago, and I saw them. And I thought they were like 6 months old. He goes, you know, no, these things are like 4 years old.
Jeez.
And I go, wow, you know, I go, what's the story? And he's just, he minimally feeds them, and he's just trying to do everything that he can to, because he, you know, I think his temperatures are probably even warmer than mine are, because I don't know if he has the ability to cool his room as much as I have the ability to cool mine. So he's probably keeping these pure diamonds at really pretty high temperatures. And the way that he battles that is that he feeds them infrequently. He grows them very slowly. They're very healthy animals. They're just very small.
Right.
I just, you know, I want to keep an animal. I want to be able to breed it, you know.
Yeah,
sure.
Get it up to size. And so I've got these 88 percenters, and I think, and it may be true, may be not true, I think they're going to flourish husbandry-wise. I think they're going to do great. They're eating great. They're strong, stellar, big animals. Now, I don't know if they'll produce in my
right.
temperatures. I don't.
Right. Interesting. The other thing that I was going to bring up while you guys were talking was mention your videos. and when you were talking about sex and carpets, and I was going to say that the advantage that you got are those awesome glasses.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I've gotten a lot of flack over those glasses, gotten some kudos. And I'll be honest, those are not my glasses. I borrow those glasses from a buddy of mine. He's a vascular surgeon here in Texas. And, he uses them on a daily basis. I borrow them a few times a year. They're nothing but fancy magnifying glasses. They've got like two and a half power magnifiers. They're called Loups, LOUPS.
Okay.
And listen, I'm a guy that's approaching 50 years of age. My close-up vision is not what it used to be. Certainly not stellar. But I put those things on, and I can literally see through the hemipenes of a baby carpet python. That's
heck
no joke.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I'm like, so I'm kind of Clark Kent, Superman. Put your glasses on.
Good stuff.
I've seen that same thing with sexing geckos. The couple people over here, I think it's the Razor Sharp Reptiles, they have geckos, and I saw one of them with one of those little jeweler's loops like they use for like checking out diamonds or something like that underneath the and he's holding up the little gecko in this little deli cup, and he's got that jeweler's loop right up to it. He goes, "I see a bump, it's a boy." I'm like, "Oh, all right." For like the longest time I'm watching him across the show, I'm like, "What the hell is he doing with that gecko?" So, it took me a minute to figure it out. But, who knows? Maybe it'll catch on. We'll get glasses. So,
this is the first year I've used them. And the first clutch of carpets that I produced, I did not use them. It was a big clutch, 28 clutch. Me and my son, he kind of holds the animal, and I do the sexing, and we both kind of look at the same time, male, female. Well, it took us like an hour, to sex these 20 babies. Well, the first time I put these loops on, again, I think it was a 26-egg clutch. And we had those things sexed in 20 minutes. No exaggeration. I mean, it was so fast and so clear. So clear. Again, I think a lot of people buy carpets. They buy a male, they buy a female. Well, maybe it's a male, maybe it's a female. With these things on, I can just, I'm very confident, when I tell you it's a male, it's a female, whatever, and it gives me some peace of mind. I don't like to sell an animal and tell somebody I think it's female, I think it's male. If it's not, 2 years from now, we'll work something out. It just gives me a lot of peace of mind to be able to just say, hey, it's a male, I guarantee it's a male.
Heck yeah. Yeah, that's awesome stuff. That's a cool video, by the way, and I really dug it. I hope you do more. You don't see many carpet python videos out there, and it's cool to see.
You're talking about the video where I did the assist feed, right? Like a pink head or something. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I tried to do a video on sexing baby carpets. Put the glasses on, got the camera out, but I just do not have access to a video camera that's high def enough to be able to show those tiny hemipenes. I was able to take a picture. I was able to get some pictures of popping a male. I really wanted to make a video of, a live video of popping a male, popping a female, but I just have not been able to find a camera that can capture it yet.
Right.
I'll keep looking.
There you go. Well, you bring up the video about the assist feeding. Maybe you could hit a little bit on that, what you're doing there.
Sure. You guys probably know Owen has produced, if he's produced hundreds of carpet or Morelia babies, these things are bulletproof. I told a buddy of mine, a chondro buddy, that I've never lost a baby carpet. Never. Once it comes out of the egg, I've had some babies die in the egg or crawl out of the egg and half in, half out, die, whatever.
Yeah,
they come out of that egg,
good when they come out, yeah.
Well, if they look normal, I've never lost one. And that certainly isn't the case in the chondro community. So the bottom line is that they're pretty bulletproof. I used to get so freaked out when they wouldn't eat after their first shed, or they wouldn't eat after the second week after their shed, or the third week, it just stressed the hell out of me. But I've learned to be patient, and it seems to be the big, healthy, fat ones. They'll come out, and they may not eat for 8 weeks after they
get. I hate that.
You know? It does. But the whole time, it's not like they're losing weight. It's not like they're skinny. They're not failure to thrive. They just don't eat. And so one of the things I've learned is just be patient with them. You know, continue to offer them. All of my babies, their first meal is a hopper, a small hopper mouse. I think that they, and I think Nick has described this, they like the movement. They like the activity. They don't want something that's going to just lay there like a pink. You know, these animals can eat huge meals, these babies. And so I offer them all a hopper mouse. Once they eat that, their next meal is a frozen thawed hopper mouse. And then after that, they get nothing but rat pinks. And
right.
There's a little controversy there. You know, Nick and Justin in their book make it very clear. They are not a fan of that strategy at all. They think that feeding rat pinks early, you know, result in loose and runny stools and an increased risk of rectal prolapse. I've never seen either of those in any of the babies I've ever produced.
Yeah, neither have I.
I'm much more concerned about them, you know, being a juvenile, being a mouse eater, you know, males, okay, whatever. You're gonna eat mice. But, you know, you get a female carpet that's a mouser, I don't want it. You know, I just don't want it. So I get all of my babies feeding frozen thawed rat pinks, and 90% of them will do it, you know, within 2 months of being hatched. The video
right.
that I made was actually, I'd say probably 1 in 100 or maybe one in 100 carpets I will assist feed. And the baby in that video was actually a twin. They were twin zebras. One of them ate immediately. One of them ate immediately on its own. The other one didn't eat really only after a couple of weeks, but it was so small that I felt like I just wanted to get something in its stomach. So I did assist feed it a mouse head, a day-old mouse pink head. And this is something that the Chondro guys do religiously. They do it all the time. I mean, so many of those babies are poor starters, poor feeders. It's just in their repertoire. And, you know, the first time I assist fed a baby carpet, I didn't have any information to rely on. I mean, I knew this thing was going to die. It hadn't eaten in months, and so it just stressed the hell out of me, and I basically just shoved this thing, you know, down this carpet's gullet and was sweating bullets the whole time, and took me a long time, and I was, you know, shaking, and but it doesn't have to be that way, you know, so I wanted to throw a video out there. You don't have to feed the whole pink, you know, you can just cut the head off, get some tweezers, put it in its mouth. You know, it's a lot easier, a lot less stressful on you, a lot less stressful on the snake. And sure enough, the next time I offered that baby zebra, he ate on its own. So, you know, just a little tricks you learn along the way. And kind of going back to that, again, it's our responsibility, I think, to teach people that have less experience with carpets because they're different.
Yeah.
They're different. They're different than what they may be used to keeping. They're different than ball pythons. You can't assist feed a baby carpet like you assist feed a baby ball python. They will not just open their mouth, latch on, and take it. I mean, you've got to forcibly put that thing in the back of their mouth.
You know, they're going to fight you.
You know, they're going to fight you. They're going to spit it out unless you get it back there where they can't. And I didn't know that first time I tried it. And I think a lot of people don't know that. So, you know, just trying to share some things that I've learned the hard way.
Wow, good stuff. So keep them coming. Yeah.
I'm going to try.
Good stuff, yeah.
What do you guys think about the rat pink versus hopper mice for babies? Owen, I mean,
I've never noticed a problem with, then I do the same thing you do, with switching them over to rat pinks. I've kind of been not swapping them over to rat pinks as early, and I've just been kind of waiting for them to get to rat fuzzies or weanlings, just not because of that I think it's something dangerous, just because of my own, I can get mice cheaper and all that other stuff, so I'm kind of waiting for that kind of stuff to happen. But I've not noticed any kind of problems, and I've had snakes grow up on rats and then decide they don't want them anymore. And my one male Echo is feeding rats his entire life, and he's now
close to breeding age and decided he wants nothing but mice. So I have to give him like 4 or 5 mice a feeding, but, you know, annoying little bastard. But, you know, it is what it is. I've not seen anything or noticed any issues with it.
You know, and again, a male, that wouldn't bother me one bit.
No, I don't care.
No, but if you're trying to put fat on a, you know, a breeding female that you're getting ready to lock up for the winter, you don't want to be feeding that thing 15 mice, you know?
Oh, Lord, no. Hell no. See, and it's funny because my friend who breeds monitors, I get a pack of jumbo rats, and there's 10 rats in a pack. And that's one feeding for one of his monitors if they're really hungry.
Oh my God.
Like, holy crap, dude. So he's like, yeah, I have to stop them from eating. You know, I can't just feed them until they want to stop. I have to physically prevent them from eating. So otherwise he's going to be out of a whole freezer by the end of the day. So it's weird.
Now with me, I fed in the past where I fed, like, you know, weekly or like on any kind of regimented schedule, I've noticed that my carpets were picky feeders. Well, some of them, I shouldn't say all of them, but the whole theory that I've noticed this with IJs in particular, with them not taking rats, you know, and then you got the opposite where jungles don't take mice or don't take rats either. And I have noticed that. But when I changed to feedings, like cycle feeding, where I'll feed as you come closer to the breeding season, I can feed them anything. So when I learned that, I kind of geared away from the whole switching them over to rats as fast as possible. And I've never had a problem since. So I start them just like you on hoppers. And I keep feeding them all the way up until they can take a mouse, and then I just switch them over to small rats. So.
And no trouble with people or animals that won't transition over?
I have not had it. I have had it in the past when I fed the way I fed. But to me, it seems like when they're hungry, they're going to eat whatever you put in front of them. You know what I mean? So it could just be the way that I'm keeping, you know. I know Owen, you feed like biweekly, right, Owen? Or you feed weekly up until a certain age and then you kind of gear it back, right? Right.
Yeah, I feed weekly up to a certain age, and by weekly I mean like there's a 7-day period and I'm going to feed at one point during this 7-day period, because even now I find it difficult to get down there. It used to be in college, like every Wednesday I'll feed. Now I've got stuff to do. So it's hard to kind of do all that. But they do get a feeding every 7 days, and then they get, once they kind of get into their yearling status, they start getting bumped down, especially if they're boys. The girls do a biweekly thing, and then the males, I've kind of adopted the, if he looks really hungry, he can have a rat. So, or if this female decided she didn't want to eat, which boy is, like, lunging at the glass, he can have a rat. So.
Right.
I've kind of bumped it down because I need to get some of my males kind of wheeled in here a little bit. It's kind of hard to breed pyro with anything, you know, smaller than 7 feet long, and that's kind of hard to come by. So,
I did have an issue when I was feeding pinks. I don't know if it's related or if it's not, but I had a brettle, and the brettle prolapsed. I did notice before it prolapsed, the stool was runny, but because I was feeding pinks, I kind of felt, and these were rat pinks, I kind of felt that that was just the way it was. And after that happened and I couldn't fix it, and the animal ended up dying, I kind of just adopted the go straight to mice and switch it over after.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly, you know, everybody's experience dictates their husbandry, and that's
sure.
The way that it should be.
Yeah.
If that would have happened to me, then I would, you know, certainly be considering, you know, changing the way that I do things. That's just your experience. That's what teaches you. That's what gives you experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was, oh man, I never forget that. I thought that I had the impression that carpets, as far as Morelli go, were kind of bulletproof when it comes to that kind of stuff. I mean, you hear it a lot about it in the chondro world, but I never really heard too much about it in the carpet world. So when it kind of happened, I thought, oh my God, what am I doing wrong? What did I do? Da 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 da.
I'm the only prolapsing carpet python in the world.
Oh yeah, it's all horrible, man. It was a horrible experience, and I it could be just total bullshit. That it just happened. You know, I guess that those things kind of just happen, but I haven't had a problem since. So
they do just happen, and that's exactly right. And I wouldn't have even known that they happened. I mean, I consider myself a fairly seasoned producer of carpets. I'd never even heard of prolapsing in carpets until I read Nick and Justin's book, and they described it. I've never seen it. I've produced, hundreds, really verging almost on 1,000 babies, and I haven't seen it. So again, things like that, they just happen. You know, it's nothing that you did wrong, or it's not probably even a feeding issue. I mean, they just happen.
Yeah.
We had a Malukan prolapse over here, and that was scary enough. We did get him to the vet and get it pushed in, and he was able to feed and poop and everything normally. We ended up selling him to a friend of ours who just wanted a Malukan as a pet, because we didn't want to take the chance of pushing him for breeding or having him prolapse or do anything like that. So it's just one of those things. But yeah,
has it reoccurred, Owen? Do you know, has it reoccurred?
No. And we got updated pictures. He's grown, he's eaten, he's doing his thing, and it's just like now it's really nice that he's not a breeder. We don't even want to consider it, because in his best interest to have that stress and to possibly prolapse during breeding or when trying to gain weight or something like that, it's just one less thing that animal needs to worry about, and that's fine.
Right.
By us.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah.
But,
absolutely.
Not fun.
No.
No. So no, when your animals are sick or they're not healthy, boy, it taps the fun out of it real fast.
Yeah.
I do have a question, though. With all those thousands of carpets that you've produced, have you ever done maternal incubation?
I said hundreds.
Oh, sorry.
yeah. Whoa now, bucko.
I have not tried it. I've lived vicariously enough through others that have. I think it's a great modality. I think it's very successful. I wouldn't say that artificial incubation is better or worse. It just is something for me that I've got something that works for me, and artificial incubation works for me. I keep pretty meticulous records of my hatch rate, eggs laid, eggs hatched, and I've got a high success rate. I mean, I've got a 90 plus success rate for the eggs that once they are laid and I remove them from the mother and I incubate them. And, my number one goal is I want the highest percentage hatch rate that I can get. If I thought maternal incubation offered a higher percentage hatch rate, I'd do it every time. But just at least in my hands, artificial incubation to me has been successful. I do a substrateless straight bake at 88 degrees. In a homemade incubator, and I have very good success. And again, like I said, I've seen enough pictures, videos, some very cool stuff, maternal incubation. I saw a picture of a female carpet, I can't even remember what it was, eating, while she was on her eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Just awesome, a fantastic experience. I'm sure that would be to see that. Or to see baby worms coming out of, out of a mother that's hatched her eggs. I mean,
out of mama's coils. Yeah,
absolutely.
I might have to do maternal this year, just because if I get the sheer number of eggs,
You don't have a big enough ego.
I may have, because here's the thing. It's going to be one of those, crap, which ones need to go in the incubator? The important ones, you know. Oh, God, you normal jungles. You guys eat, maternally incubate that. I mean, it's going to be one of those things. So,
Eric, what about you? Have you done it, Eric?
That's all he does.
Yeah.
That's all he does. Yeah.
That's all you do.
Yeah, except when, you know, there's a incubating box in someone else's incubator, or when there's a box. Yeah, when there's a box in his own incubator sometimes. I mean, those are always fun.
This past year, I started to do maternal incubation with my caramel female. And for some reason, I pulled her to take a peek at the eggs, and I noticed that she still had an egg in her. So I pulled those. Actually, it ended up being, what, 3 eggs, Owen? So we,
3 eggs,
Owen,
yeah.
Yeah, Owen got them out of her, and I pulled her off the eggs because, you know, I didn't want to put her through that. So, but otherwise, I would just leave them, you know.
You're not planning on breeding her this year, correct?
No. I mean, she's eating. She's doing good. She's put on weight. No issues that I can see. It's not swelling or anything like that. So I think she may be good, but I'm just going to give her another year, let her grow up and heal up or whatever and see what happens. But,
the other thing we haven't touched on at all, is the chondro bug.
Right.
Yeah.
Do either one of you guys own chondros? Eric, you do, right?
I do not.
I did, and I had to trade them for a fabulous...
You didn't have to.
No, I had to because it was a red tiger female. She was fabulous, and she would go perfect with a project that I was doing, so I reluctantly... let my I had a Biak female that I got from Buddy Buscemi and Zach.
Yeah.
Zach Baez has her now, but I know she's in good hands, and one day he'll breed them, and I'll be able to get offspring from that. But I love chondros, man. I have to get back into them and get them going. But what do you have going on?
You know, I think I told you in an email I'm a total chondro newbie. For the longest time, they scared the crap out of me. I mean, at first, you know, I was scared because I thought that their temperament was, you know, they were, you know, vicious jungle snakes that just would bite anybody's head off. When I did some research, I figured out that is certainly not the case. It's the complete opposite of that in most animals, not the Biaks, of course. But now they scare me because of the husbandry aspect. But I'm getting over that fear. They have the reputation, and I've known some very skilled keepers that have dealt with respiratory infections, prolapse. The babies could be notoriously difficult to get going. But in spite of all of that, I've had some people that have coaxed me along the way, people that have crossed over between the carpet and the chondro world, guys like Barry Manson, Joe Montini, and John from the Trophy Club, and, you know, Zach, all sorts of people, Gary Schiavino, all these people keep carpets and chondros, and, you know, I'm in love with them. I'm fascinated by them. I've got what's called chondro fever. A year ago, I didn't even know, you know, one iota about them. And, you know, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have 20 animals. So I have a lot to learn. I am planning on breeding some chondros this year. Okay. I'm keeping half a dozen right now, and so far so good. They're doing well. I'm enjoying them. I've got a couple that I'm watching them go through their ontogenic color change, and that is very cool. You know, when they change from a yellow or a red Neo to a, you know, to an adult.
Yes.
Very, very cool stuff. So
yeah,
I'm hooked on them. And we talked a little bit about the Condro community before, and they're a good group of people. And I got to meet them, and I know you got to meet them. A lot of them at the ICAS. Very supportive, very passionate people.
Yes.
Similar to the carpet people.
Absolutely. I would agree. Yeah, I think that similar to you, I kind of had the same mindset with Condros. And after keeping them for a while, I kind of just realized that it's just a python that is in a tree, or, you know, that perches.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It kind of lost that scariness, so to speak, you know?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the myths is that you can't handle a Condro because it won't tolerate it, or it's going to bite you. You know, it's just going to be biting. You take it out of the cage, and you know, that's just not true. It's not like a ball python that you can just handle it all day, every day. I mean, you know, but in small doses during the day when it's not, you know, on its feeding rampage, they're very handleable. It's good to handle them. It gives them some exercise. It, you know, keeps their gut going. And I think so many people don't realize that. That is my next mission. I've tried to do it with carpets, but my next mission is I'm going to get people to know Condros. So I'm going to get the people that can take care of a ball python and can take care of it well, they can keep a Condro. With a little bit
Absolutely.
Of coaching, a little encouragement, they can keep a Condro and they can keep one healthy. And the problem is you never see them at shows. And when you do see them at shows, I mean, how many times I've never seen anybody with a Condro out of its cage at a show. They're always perched. They're asleep during the day, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's I got a funny story for that. We were at, it was actually Tinley Park, and me and Julie from GFX Morelia.
I met Julie at the ICAS,
And we were splitting a table there, and when we were splitting the table, she had a Condro for sale out on the table. And, you know, people were walking by, and she pulled out this Condro, and, you know, as calm as could be, and just crawling through her hands, and, you know, and everybody was walking by was just amazed. And the person that walked up and actually bought the snake was their first python that they bought. They didn't have any of the, you know, the stigmatas. You know what I mean? The stigmas that, you know, you would normally associate with Condros, and, you know, they just came up, and Julie kind of talked to them about the Condros, and she did an awesome job, and, you know, they felt comfortable, and they took it. It was awesome, you know, because you're absolutely right. We're looking at people going around and the ball pythons all over the place, and here's this other snake, you know, and it had a certain mystique to it. And I don't know about you guys, but I remember when I first went to reptile shows, you know, those type of animals were the animals that kind of were like, oh my God, they're like the untouchable stuff. You have to be like, you know, a super duper keeper in order to be able to work with them.
Right.
You know, sometimes
and
the price
probably,
tag and the,
sure,
you know.
The price tag. And probably back then you did, because they were imported animals, you know,
yeah,
they were
right.
very difficult to keep. They were very, you know, temperament was very bad. They were hard to keep. But you know, it's different now.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and there's
yeah,
something, there's something about holding a green tree that, you know, you get it off of its perch and it goes through your fingers or it wraps around you. You know, it's not a ball python and it's not a carpet python. I mean, it's different.
Yes.
And it's cool.
I think some of the observations I saw from keeping them, one of the coolest things that I saw was when, you know, I went to feed it and there's the tail just wiggling away.
Oh,
I was like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, like, wow, that is neat, you know. And
that caudal luring, that's what they call it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cool stuff. And, you know, watching it change through the color change and as it grows. And I think the cool thing with chondros is you never know how it's going to end up. It's not really – you're kind of taking a gamble on
– Yes, you are.
You know,
yeah. Yep.
What it's going to look like, you know. So
absolutely. You know, most of them are going to end up green.
Right.
Especially if you buy a baby from green parents. The gamble starts to come in when you start buying some of these designer animals as babies. And they've all this crazy, you know, decade bloodline, this high yellow, high blue, calico, you know, just these freaky black animals. You know, that's when kind of really the Las Vegas odds start to play when, you know, when you buy a baby like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So can I ask, are you going to do anything different, say, for your chondros as far as your approach to breeding as opposed to your carpets? Or are you following the same recipe?
No, I'm going to use people that have had success breeding chondros, and I'm going to use their formula. Marshall Mendez, do you guys know Marshall? Did you meet him? Marshall's a great guy. He keeps, you know, he has a reptile room, and he keeps ball pythons, and he keeps chondros in the same room. So, and he breeds them. And so I've kind of adopted his formula for at least just keeping chondros, and a little bit different in husbandry. Obviously, he uses vertical cages with perches. You know, you have to have perches with them. All of mine have radiant heat panel. They have a vertical temperature gradient, and my basking temperatures are lower. They're, you know, probably 88 degrees. Versus my 95 degrees that I'll keep in my carpets. I'm more diligent, really, in their husbandry. My carpets get fresh water once a week. Unless I see an obvious, you know, stain or soiling in the water, I'll change it when I see that. My chondros get fresh water every 2 or 3 days. I'll clean the cages more often than the chondros. I mean, as soon as I see a soil, you know, immediately their substrate gets changed. I keep them all on newspaper or I get these. Buddy Manson, who's a dentist, who was one of the guys that got me involved in chondros, laughs at me, but I get these obstetric pads from the hospital. You know, I work at a hospital.
Right.
And these mothers that up at the hospital, they give birth, they have these special obstetric pads. They're called peri pads that, you know, they use let's just say it this way, they're very absorbent, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Gotcha.
So, I use these pads as my substrate in my chondro cages, and most people will use newspaper or other kind of bedding, but I've used these peri pads. They work, it's worked very well for me. But as soon as they get soiled, I immediately change them. Whereas my carpets, you know, if they get soiled, I'll let them go, you know, 3 or 4 days until I do my weekly cage maintenance. Other than that, you know, I do maintain the humidity higher, the levels higher with the chondros. I'll spray them. I don't spray the animal directly, but I will spray the cage, you know, every 2 or 3 days. It's very dry down here in Texas. I know some of the guys on the East Coast have gotten away from spraying their chondros, spraying the cages at all. They don't spray at all. They may just kind of moisten the substrate a little bit when the animal goes into a shed cycle. But down here it's so dry. I spray minimally. I spray just enough to ensure a good shed. At the end, if my chondros are shedding well, you know, that's the amount of humidity I want to apply, and so that's what I've been trying to do. Breeding,
cool. You
know, it's going to be a learn as you go kind of thing. I'm going to be talking to guys like you, Buddy, and Marshall, and Barry Manson, and Chris Stewart at the barn. You guys have a wealth of knowledge on condor breeding, and I'm going to use every bit of it this year. I'm going to pick their brains, and these are the kind of guys that will, you know, they'll open up to me, they'll open up to anybody, because they're so passionate about those animals, and I'm going to utilize that. I'm going to take advantage of their knowledge. Christian Stewart, the guy's he's a condor savant. I don't know. Did you get a chance to talk to him much?
I did a little bit. Yeah. You mean an eye catcher?
I had the opportunity to go out to his facility. They call it the barn. I can't even remember. I don't even remember what their business name is. But he and his brother, Sean Stewart, and I was able to go out there and see their facility, see their animals, and you know, they've got a lot of condors out there, obviously. All stages, hatchlings, subadults, adults, and Christian, he knows every single animal. He knows their habits. He knows their temperatures. He keeps a temperature gun in his hand at all times. He's constantly just shooting temperatures. And, you know, he's got these old school cages. I can't even remember what they're called, but half of them have like tinfoil up along the side, and you know they're just every single one of them is engineered specifically to the area in that facility that provides the best temperatures. I mean, he's sick. I mean, it's his job. He does it full time, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Condro guys and girls. They're intense.
They're intense
snake keeper. Yeah.
they
know their stuff, man.
they do, and they'll call you out on it, you know.
Yeah.
I was very intimidated kind of introducing myself, getting involved, but at the same time, if you're humble and you know, you have the right motivation, they'll tell you, teach you everything you need to know.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, one of the things you might look forward to, Bill, is hopefully either at the end of this month or maybe sometime next month, we're going to be doing a condro roundtable, similar to what we did with the carpets, but
nice.
Take some of the condro myths and get these breeders to come on and kind of talk about their different approaches and, you know, get a whole bunch of that information out to people so that, you know, that they don't have that stigma that they've had, and maybe we can get that erased.
That's fantastic. Do you have any idea who's going to be slated?
Well, I have one of the guys that has taken it on is Brian Fisher, and he's kind of in the condro community, and he has connections to some of the people there, but I think one of the guys from the barn was on there.
Yeah.
I know we've talked about having Buddy.
Buddy would be awesome.
Yeah. And there's a couple other guys. I really don't. I know the condro community a little bit. You know, like some of the big rollers, so to speak, or the well known people. But I think that kind of the idea too is to kind of get a little more involved with the condro part of Morelia on there. And I'm sure, without a doubt, the guys that guys or girls that he's going to have coming on will deliver the goods, you know. So it should be good stuff.
I didn't know that you guys were going to do that. I'm really looking forward to that. That will be a great show.
Yeah.
I will have nothing to contribute. So...
Oh, and you always have something to contribute.
Exactly. I'll just have to keep up with my hijinks. But you know, as a non-condro keeper, I'm just going to be like, yes, the snakes that I heard about. So, yeah.
we haven't even had a second to talk about, you know, your guys' scrub pythons. And again, maybe you've touched on this on a show that I have missed, but, I mean, your stuff is going crazy. Owen Snake gets the ICAS first
Hazel.
In show.
Yeah.
First in show. And then
yeah.
Eric starts posting these pictures of what's that animal called? Tweed? Is that what you call it? Tweed?
His Barnack, yeah.
Yeah. Tweed.
Tweed. Tweed.
That thing is insane.
Everybody loves
it's got a scale the size of its entire head.
Yeah. And that scale grows with them. It's insane. And the funny thing is now that all the scrubs are over here, like I'm getting to appreciate them more and more. I mean, first off, my female Jayapira is a bitch, but so I observe her through the glass. but so
you're not going to debunk this scrub myth of aggression.
See, now I can tell you that there are certain ones that are okay. And I think it's just because there haven't been that many captive bred and exposed through total breeding keeping course. I say that in both my Jays are captive bred. Anyway, because my female Malukan Hazel is easily handleable. You can pick her up. My male is a total jerk. And my other Padawan's female is just a psychopath. But that's just the way it works out. And then,
which one did you have at the symposium, Owen?
I had my female Hazel, who is the really nice one that you can pick up in Boca Raton.
Gotcha.
I wanted that. I mean, there's really no, I didn't want anything that would be, you know, I didn't want anybody getting bit in the face. So, but they're like, you know, they can be very handleable because, like, Eric Snake Tweed, he's handleable. But Eric, isn't the female that you have for Tweed, isn't she not a nice one?
Yeah, with the scrubs and I think you're right, Owen. The captive breeding part of it is a huge part of it. But I think that Tweed, I got Tweed from David Means, and he worked a great deal with that animal, and I think that it shows. I think that people they don't want to get bit, so they don't work with the animal, where therefore the animal becomes more defensive. One of the things with scrubs is they're smart, man.
They know where the door is. They know the noises that you're making when you're unlocking the door, and they know where to be so when the door opens to compliant. So,
they're very, I say cage aggressive, but what I've noticed is once you have them out, if you can read the snake, obviously with anything, there's going to be some that are just insane, you know, but for the most part, I've found that my group is pretty handleable, let's put it that way. But
What do you keep your scrubs in caging wise?
Believe it or not, I keep my scrubs in tubs.
Scrubs in tubs. I love tubs.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of nothing I have is really of adult size. But what I've noticed is when I keep them in caging, their sheds weren't good. I think that scrubs are very secretive animals. I think that they like to be left alone. And I think that the security that a tub and a rack provides kind of makes them feel more secure.
Right.
I've noticed that keeping my scrubs high up in the air, higher than my, you know, above my head in my room, makes them feel more secure as well. So for now I'm sticking with it. It's kind of what works, and you know, they're acclimated well and doing good, so I'm going to keep rolling with it. You know, like Halma hair scrubs, they're notorious. A lot of people have said that those scrubs need higher temperatures, and they need to be at 100% humidity, and me personally, I just can't get past the idea that it's a python. Why would it be different? Why would it be different than any other type of Python? So I keep it like that, and it's been successful. So I don't
good.
Know. So I got them eating and going, and so it must be
sweet.
Doing something right.
Exactly.
Eating, going, and then breeding. That's the order, right?
Well.
if Eric gets Helma Harry to breed, I know somebody he's selling a really nice pair to for cheap. Just saying. Just throwing that out there.
Scrubs are a cool group. I think if you're into Morelia, they're definitely worth. I mean, you could get a Tannenbar scrub, which, believe it or not, they're the smallest of the group, but definitely the most, at least in my experience, the feistiest ones of all of them. You know?
Yeah. Buddies hate him, so. I love the Malukans. If you're wanting to jump into scrubs, I can't say anything more than starting with a very young Malukan, and it's basically like a funky colored carpet python. If you catch it in the right lights as it's growing, and they change
right.
from this dark red to this really nice goldish color, they're fantastic. And then you can work your way up the ladder until you get to be like crazy me and Chris, where you're like, it'd be great right now, King Horni, and someone needs to stop us. Like anybody who can stop us needs to do so.
Yeah. So the freight train is running. I mean,
you're not going to
get in front of that thing.
No.
It's all right. Right. I'm enjoying the Site B animals here, so I get to have some more fun with these guys. Something different. So.
Do you ever see yourself getting into any scrubs, or do they catch your eye, or Bill?
To be honest, no, not right now. I think one of the things that you asked me was if, the next Morelia that I would keep. And it'd probably be a Bolens.
Bolens.
I saw the Bolens animal at the ICAS. Hell, that thing was in shed.
Yeah, I know.
When
for
I
hell.
Saw it, and it was just, and it was stunning. I mean, I was in love with it the minute that I saw it. And if indeed it stayed the size that it was when I saw it, I'd have one.
Right.
They get big. They get big.
Yes, they do.
They
now, would you consider it other than Morelia species?
I'm going to go crazy with that question. And,
do it.
Because it's a fantasy, but I think vipers are very
Jesus.
Cool. I've been to Costa Rica a couple times. I was able to see an animal down there called a Fertilance, which is
an incredibly
venomous viper that is unbelievably cool looking. I mean,
but Jesus.
Listen, this is if I could, right? I mean,
in a magical world, yeah.
I saw a Guatemalan snake called the yellow blotched palm viper.
They're
and it was
gorgeous.
Posted. Do you know that snake?
Yes.
God, I've never seen it. A guy on the MVF forum by a guy named Brooke Burnstone, I think, posted one that was just unbelievable. I mean, phenomenal looking snake. So
they got the coolest looking eyes, and then their scales just make it look even more badass. So,
God, and then the yellow and the green in it just fluorescent, just bright.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, I think I had a rubber version of that when I was a kid.
There you go.
I think I had a rubber snake that looked like that, but So I'm gonna go out on the limb. I'm gonna shoot for the stars.
Go out on that limb. Yeah, all right. It's a nice limb.
Yeah.
Cool.
What about you? I mean, let me turn the question right back to you. What would you guys have?
Well, my answer, thing is, when I gave this answer way back when we did, like, the first episode of Morelia Python Radio, my answer was for non-Morelia with blackface, white lips. So,
okay.
You know, I've achieved that. And, of course, now I have to say for my Morelia that I won, it's still the rough scale python because I haven't gotten that yet and it kills me every day. For the non-Morelia, I have no freaking idea right now. Shoot. I'm used to this question.
It's okay. I had to think about my answer for a long time. I mean,
yeah.
It's a tough question.
I don't know. There's so many things that I want. I would have to say that I really want some of those silver Savu just because I still need Savu for my Liasis portion of this thing going on over here. But
yeah.
I would absolutely love just to have they call them dragon rat snakes. Or I don't know if you guys have ever seen them. They're like armor-plated snakes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
I've seen that.
Yeah, yeah, they
well,
are
I haven't
gorgeous.
Seen those. Where are they from? Indonesia?
I believe Indo because last time we had Ari on, we were talking about it, and he posted a bunch of pictures of the dragon rat snake that he found just by walking around. And in return, I had to post pictures of my blackface white lips on his Facebook page. So
gotcha.
Yeah. He demanded pictures, so we kind of swapped. So yeah, I don't know. They're cool little snakes. Just the you know the way they look like they have bearded dragon scales planted on a rat snake. It's kind of cool. So
Eric, what about
that's
you?
Where I would go.
Oh man, well. Morelia-wise, that's a toss-up between Bolens and Owen Pelly pythons.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, that's very good.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough one for me, but there's so many Morelia that I want. As far as non-Morelia, that's probably the harder question for me.
That's a tough question.
Non-Morelia. I'm gonna totally
go something
totally
crazy. something that you never have.
Oh, that's impossible for him.
I would probably go back to my younger days of keeping, and I would
don't
really
say it.
What
Burmese?
What you, no.
No,
although,
I thought you were gonna jump back to Burmese python.
No. I would probably go with a Gaboon Viper. After seeing it, I saw a picture of it.
Nice.
I saw a picture of it on the Facebook the other day. And when I was young, my dad had a pair of them. And, man, they are beautiful, beautiful animals.
See, Eric, you're the guy I'm talking about. You know, when they were kids, they were exposed to animals like that.
Yes.
You know, your dad kept them.
Yeah.
You know, I told you what happened to me. That those are the Boom Vipers, and I'd be on fire right now. Fire.
Yeah. We would not be speaking to you, yeah.
No.
Done.
I'd be the Phoenix, man. I'd be reborn from some ashes somewhere.
I was extremely lucky as a kid. You know, my dad, he kind of started the fire in the reptiles for me. I think it started with a green anole. And, you know, ever since then, it's kept growing and growing and growing. I think I was maybe 5 years old when I got that green anole. And, you know, it went from there. I think my first snake was a garter snake. I think he brought home. And, you know, I just would stare at that thing for hours. And, you know, I wanted something bigger. I got a rat snake. And then it turned into a Burmese python. And then for a while, he got into it again. And that's when everything went wild. I mean, we had monocle cobras. We had saloon vipers. We had copperheads, eastern diamondbacks, western diamondbacks, Burmese pythons, Indian pythons, ball pythons. What else? We had a caiman, tegus, iguanas, copperheads, cottonmouths.
What a freak
western
show.
Diamondback, eastern diamondback, boa constrictors.
Jeez.
Man, I don't. It's probably easier to tell you what we didn't have.
Sounds like it.
To what we
carpet
did.
Python. That's what he didn't have.
He did
and,
not. No, he
what?
Didn't. He
no,
never had
exactly.
any kind of Morelia, but yeah,
so
it was
you're
definitely
making up for lost time.
Yeah, definitely cool stuff that. I was exposed to growing up, and I was lucky. So,
well, yes, stuff. You were lucky.
Yeah. So that's why I can't shake the bug, man. It's with me for life. You know.
No, it's a bug that's deep seated in all
yeah.
of us. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
Right. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that, you know, just as I was inspired when I was a kid, my goal, just like you were saying earlier, is to inspire other people to see the beauty in reptiles. And, you know, it doesn't matter what kind it is, just as long as, you know, people can learn to appreciate them, you know. So
Have you guys ever done a school show where you take, like, snakes up to an elementary school?
I would love to. You mean on the radio show or like just personally?
No,
talking
just,
in front
no,
of kids
in person.
Yeah, I have done that. Yep.
Yeah, that's very fulfilling. I've done that. My wife's a teacher, and I haven't done it in the last few years. But there's nothing like taking a group of snakes up to an elementary school, fifth or sixth grade class. And you start taking these things out, and before you know it, you have the entire school packed into a classroom. You know, just they're in awe of them.
Yeah.
You know, they have no experience, no exposure to the animals
sure.
until you bring them into the classroom.
Yeah.
And
right.
it's.
I used to do shows with the zoo, and there's nothing like exposing animals to some kids. I mean, they eat it up. They don't give a crap what the hell you're saying or doing. They're either fixing that animal and that's it. They're done.
No. All they want to do is hold that thing. All they want to do, they want to get their hands on it. They just want to hold it. You're right. They don't care what you're saying. You know, you could be saying, don't touch its head. Don't, you know, squeeze it too hard. All that's la, 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 la. Let me put my hands on it.
Nope. The first thing they do is poke the snake in the head. Like, what the hell is this?
I know. What is it? They want to touch the snake's head. They're like, hey, don't touch the snake's head. You know?
Yeah. Point.
Yeah.
Well, good stuff. Good stuff. Well, we are just, I mean, we went into overtime and we're just about out of time. So I guess before we jump off, we have to make sure that we get your website and how people can find out what you got going on and throw all that out there.
Sure. PhoenixReptiles.net is my website. I'm on Facebook too. Phoenix Reptiles Snakes or Bill Stiegel. Either one of those will get my Facebook. And certainly have a lot of friends, you know, in the Morelia community and making more, seems like every day. Again, I can't thank you guys enough for the work that you put into this show. It's one of the reasons why our community is growing. Our community is growing leaps and bounds, and can't thank you guys enough for doing it.
Cool.
That's a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, good stuff, man, and best of luck with the upcoming season for you. And anytime you want to come back, man, just say the word.
Let us know.
I appreciate it. Obviously, good luck with you guys. It was great to meet you in Maryland, and I'm sorry we didn't get to spend more time together then, but it's been a nice couple hours talking to you guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll catch you soon, okay?
All right. Take care, guys.
All right.
All right. All right.
Good stuff, man. There we go. Yeah, what a cool guy, man. Bill's a great guy.
And it's definitely very cool to find somebody who kind of didn't get into it till later on. Like, you were born into it, and I didn't get into it till college. So it's always cool to hear from the people who kind of always liked it from afar and kind of couldn't get into it till later.
Sure. And for somebody that's hasn't been in it for, you know, got into it later in life, sure has pushed himself along rather quickly with a huge amount of success. So, good stuff.
Very much. Very cool. So, it's also nice talking to Mike in there, too. So.
Yeah. The Ocelot. Yeah, that's crazy stuff.
Cool.
Next week we have Eugene Bissette.
Holy crap, we keep running over, and you're going to bring Eugene Bissette in. We're not going to be another step overtime.
Set your calendar, Owen, because,
It's good stuff. We're tired going into work on Wednesday. All right, good to know.
I look forward to talking with Eugene. I should say I look forward to listening to Eugene because he is a wealth of knowledge and
information and stories and everything under the sun. Your dog wants you.
Yeah, I see that. Speaking of just on a quick side.
Hey, I lost the phone, dude.
Did you see the picture that Josh put up on Facebook with the Datsun on the stilts?
No.
He put it on my Facebook page, Eric Burke, and it's basically this Datsun, and it's on stilts. And it says, they told me I could be anything that I want to be. So I want to be a Doberman Pinscher. That's awesome.
Perfect.
So I'm going to be known for Morelia and Datsuns.
You're done. Just hit over.
Cool stuff. Cool. So, next week, Eugene, we'll just give some shout-outs real quick, and then we'll call it a night. Morelia Python forums, www.moreliapythons.com. The chat is going on Tuesdays, and I know they're trying to get one going on Thursday, which is cool. Or Fridays. I'm
sorry. All right. Yep.
I promised Mr. Behoff that I would give him a shout out for Carpet Python Classified page.
Yep.
That's over on Facebook, so go over there and check it out. Definitely some really, really nice carpet pythons on there.
Very nice carpet pythons.
Best carpet python breeders around. So if you're looking for carpet pythons, go check it out over there, Carpet Python Classifieds on Facebook, and you should be able to find it. What else do I have? MoreliaPythonRadio.com. That will take you to everything you need to know about us. Cool news,
yay.
Tip of the week, interesting stories about Owen.
They are interesting.
Cool stuff. So, go over there and check that out. And, of course, for me, there's EB Morelia, www.ebmorelia.com. If you have any questions, comments, you'd like to hear a certain guest, or if you have questions for an upcoming guest, feel free to contact us at info@moreliapythonradio.com, and we'll do our best to answer your questions as fast as possible. I think that is all I have. All I got. Go ahead, Owen. It's all you.
All right. What we got here is you can go onto Facebook and look for Rogue Reptiles at facebook.com. It gets you all the latest happenings of Rogue.
also gets you first dibs on any babies that are up for sale. You can also go to rogue-reptiles.com with all the latest happenings at Rogue. We just posted up our 15 pairings that we're doing for the 2014 season. You can go check it out, see what's going to be cooking at Rogue this season. If there's anything you might like, you can contact us for some things, not everything. We're not taking lists on everything, but just a few choice things. You can also go through Twitter and look for Rogue under Rogue_Reptiles. Follow us there. Every once in a while we do some things on Twitter and Facebook with that. Other than that, I think we got a show in Oaks in September. I'll let you guys know when that's coming up. And we have the October 19th Hamburg show. With that, I will say good night, everybody, and we will see you next week for some more Morelia Python Radio.